Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're talking about invisibility in D&D. You know, it's an iconic and surprisingly complicated spell. Is it overpowered? Does it need some nerfing? We're going to break down all the takes and nuances and come up with the best ways to handle it when your PCs disappear from sight. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into today's discussion, I will remind everyone that, as always, at the end of the show, we will be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat between Dan and I and all of our viewers or all of our patrons who have signed up at our Patreon. So you can join in by visiting our Patreon. Go to patreon.com/wanderingdms, join at any tier, and you'll get an invite to our private Discord server. Get your account on Discord all set up, and maybe about 10 minutes or 15 minutes after the end of the show, Dan and I will be there to talk to you all live.
We have the best patrons. For example, Backwius is telling us that we are currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream. Thank you so much. We would love for you to join our patrons and get in on that video after chat on our Discord server. So, invisibility. This is one of these questions that came up, Paul, from our holiday game with in the Lost Caverns of Saj Camp, actually, where you, in particular, were doing a lot of clever... troublesome to me, the DM scouting invisibly, and your team was using the invisibility sphere, or what used to be called invisibility 10-foot radius, and I was kind of doing a post-mortem myself, making sure that I was doing that right, had kind of a conversation show up on our Discord server with a lot of really interesting takes, as a matter of fact, which is I kind of wanted to share some of those takes, as a matter of fact. Now, invisibility, right, obviously... The one canonical place where this is being inspired from is the primary ability of the One Ring in Lord of the Rings. The whole major one magic item that we think about that clearly inspired D&D at the root of it. It's such an important ability. It's the magic ability to start them all in some sense. Long before Lord of the Rings, there's long tradition in legends of myths of powers like invisibility. There's a lot of allusions to a cloak of invisibility. There's the Helm of Hades. There's the Ring of Gyges in Greek myth that all do that kind of stuff. And it's used a whole lot in Homer. All through the Iliad has, I don't know, like a dozen different examples of the gods hiding their favorite heroes in a dark mist and letting them escape what would clearly be a mortal injury on the battlefield. And then, we as we tape this, there is the Christopher Nolan version of The Odyssey currently in theaters right now. And so I thought that I might read a little bit from Alexander Pope's translation of The Odyssey by Homer. And this little bit is in Book 7, where the Odysseus is washed up alone at the city of Phaeacia. And he's greeted, he doesn't realize it, but he's greeted by his patron deity, Pallas Athena. And so here's Alexander Pope's take, which he translated in verse for what it's worth. Thus having spoke, the unknown celestial leads the footsteps of the deity he treads, and secret moves along the crowded space, unseen of all the rude Phaeacian race. So Pallas ordered, Pallas to their eyes the mist objected and condensed the skies. The chief with wonder sees the extended streets, the spreading harbors, and the riding fleets. And kind of goes on from there. So Athena has shrouded Odysseus in what they describe as a mist. He can see the god that did this. They're talking to each other. He's following her through the streets. But he can go through the entire city. He gets into the royal palace. No one can see him. And he winds up, he can scout out all the armies and the fleets and the defenses and the towers and all that kind of stuff. And he actually walks into the banquet hall walks straight up to the queen on her throne, throws himself at her feet, grabs her legs, and only then does the mist dissipate, and he begs for mercy. And the queen, of course, everybody is very, very surprised at this this distraught dude having just appeared, actually grappling in an actual grapple with the royalty. And so that's the case. That's where it happens. Now, no spoilers from the movie, by the way, because I'm going to see it probably in a couple weeks. I don't know if that's depicted in the movie. Don't tell me if it is. But that happens in the Odyssey and at least a dozen times in the Iliad. So for me, I will say that's how I personally think about an invisibility power myself. Maybe other people differ.
Interesting. Interesting. I wonder if that's our origin of an attack dispels invisibility. Did Odysseus attack the queen by throwing himself at her feet? Could you construe that?
Question mark?
It's actually one of the interesting points I wanted to talk about is like what cancels invisibility. But before we get into that, let's just talk about like there are a dozen flavors of invisibility in D&D. Right?
Yeah.
There's spell. There's obviously there's magic items like your elven cloak. There's just hiding, which you know isn't really invisibility, but is effectively hiding. Right. You've got both the thief skill to hide in shadows. You've got elves and hobbits who can hide in the woods. There's like a lot of things in this game that obscure your ability to see your opponent.
Even if you just talk about the spell alone, like just if you look at first edition, you have the spell invisibility, 10-foot radius, mass invisibility, improved invisibility. There's at least four spells alone on the wizard list in first edition.
I mean, you could even argue that just the very playing with light is almost a form of invisibility. That if we are moving into a dark dungeon and the torch goes out or someone casts darkness or something, effectively we can't see each other anymore, and that's almost a form of invisibility.
If you dig into it's a really interesting observation, because if you dig into the chainmail game that preceded D&D by a couple of years, again, you know, they don't use the completely legally precise language all the time, and there's a little bit of ambiguity. They tend to use the word hidden or invisible, and maybe it means the same thing or maybe not. So it's like, you know, a particular types of monsters can be unseen until they attack, and then other monsters have abilities that they can detect hidden things or they can detect invisible things. Is that exactly this? Are they talking about exactly the same thing? A little bit arguable one way or the other.
Fascinating. So I think mechanically, like one of the things that we struggle with a lot and that I see a lot of variation with across different editions and whatnot is how long does it last? When does it end?
Well, okay. This is the main theme, right? So the first place it shows up, of course, is in chainmail. And it shows up specifically in some monster descriptions. So monsters like sprites and pixies and elves and wizards all say that they're unseen, they're invisible until they attack. And actually, I'm just going to read the snippet from the elf. So it says, for the elf, it says, when invisible, elves and fairies cannot attack or be attacked unless located by an enemy with a special ability to detect hidden or invisible troops, but they can become visible and attack during the same turn. So that's the origin of this. And then you have monsters like things that can detect invisibility would be dragons. Okay, like Smaug, maybe, with Bilbo, right? Bilbo can't entirely go undetected by Smaug. Wraiths, who can still track the ring bearer even when they're trying to use the invisibility power, right? That's all canonical in chainmail. Dragon, superheroes. Superheroes specifically have the ability to detect invisible, like I guess Conan has special wits about him to not be surprised, and then wizards can cast a spell to do that. So, you know, you might ask, like, what is this trying to allude to, that elves can be invisible? And later on it gets interpreted as, well, they can hide in, they're hiding in woods, or they have special cloaks that are chameleon type powers and stuff like that. And all it says, right, again, very briefly, is they're just invisible until they attack. Now, in chainmail, the fights are only going to last a couple minutes. So there's a lot of powers in chainmail where just no one ever thought about having to set any kind of limited duration on it, because if anything lasts more than 10 or 20 minutes, it's a non-issue. And that's an ability that when it got into original D&D, when it got into first edition, was similarly just unlimited until you attacked or had a dispel cast at you. I actually, and then the question is that overpowered, right? And the history of invisibility in D&D is mostly trying to dial down that enormous capacity, usually through the duration. Can you pull up the image I prepared? It's got, it doesn't have any colored dot on it at all. It's just about five lines of text.
Hang on, I got that one.
Yeah. It's just really enormous. Okay, so if you look at the additions to the history of D&D, in first edition, the invisibility spell is just permanent. It just lasts forever until dispelled. It gets used for a lot of tricks in first edition adventures of a potion that's permanently invisible, or a dagger, or a book, or a box of treasure that you can't see, right? In second edition, usually kept the exact same rules, but second edition D&D reduced the duration to 1 day. The 3.0 edition reduced it to 10 minutes per level. 3.5 reduced it to 1 minute per level. And the current fifth edition rules, it's just as long as you can concentrate on it. So there's this complete cliff-like reduction in the duration. I'm wondering which one is best. I'm used to, it being permanent.
It's very interesting, because I think you just brought up so many issues here all in one breath that I'm not sure what to respond to. But let's start with the duration, the straight duration. I think one of the things that really causes this a problem is, what is the target of invisibility? Is it a person, or can you cast it on an object? And if you cast it on an object, I worry sometimes that this is like this weird retroactive attempt to explain things like, oh, in this dungeon, this wall is invisible, or the you know, there's this trap is invisible. So they've figured out, well, then there must be some way for a wizard to cast invisibility on an object. And this goes all the way back to original edition. In original edition, just the description, which is super short, just says a spell which lasts until it's broken by the user or by some outside force. Remember that, as in chainmail, a character cannot remain invisible in attack. It affects only the person or thing upon whom or which it is cast. So already we have thing in there, this vague, like it could be cast on a thing. And then by comparison, I was looking this up in BX, which tells us that it can be cast on any one person or object in range. And then when talking about becoming visible, it says any invisible item will become visible once again and remain visible when it leaves the character's possession, is set down, dropped, and so forth. Mm-hmm. Which implies that I couldn't cast it on my treasure chest or a wall or a trap and walk away, because it's immediately out of my possession, right?
Okay.
It's very unclear that when you get into the whole item aspect of it, because classically, your thing that's going to end invisibility is attacking. But if I cast it on an object, objects don't attack people. So is this just permanently invisible? If I cast invisibility on my sword and I attack someone, well, is it the sword or the man that's doing the attacking?
The way I read an original D&D, if it was cast on an object, it would actually be permanent until someone got it by with a dispel. And it's interesting because you're right. First edition, it only says creature touched for the effect possibility. So that seems to be clarified or stricken out in first edition.
There's a lot of back and forth in the editions, I think, about whether or not it affects objects.
Yeah.
And that just causes so many weird problems once you allow it to affect objects. But it's been in there, like I said, from original. Mm-hmm. I haven't looked up where it goes in third and fifth, but
Things generally only get more restrictive with time. So if you can't do it on an object in first edition, I think I'm going to stipulate that you probably can't use it an object in any later edition. Maybe someone can correct us on that.
Do you allow it to be cast on objects, Dan?
Actually reading, reading original D&D is my normal source text. I do. I don't think I've ever seen a character, a player character, do that. And I will say that, you know, dungeon, you know, placement isn't restricted to only the spells you see in the book. And Gary would talk about that a lot, is that, you know, more powerful wizards presumably have their own specialized spells. So even if the traditional second level spell couldn't do it, presumably there's some other higher level spell that you could use to make a wall or a pit invisible anyway. So I don't think it'd be restricted with your dungeon design either way.
Just as a point of comparison, because we had Kelsey on the show very recently, I did pull out my copy of Shadow Dark to see what the Shadow Dark do with invisibility. The answer is the duration is 10 rounds, and it is absolutely limited to a creature.
Yeah.
So possibly, if I pull up your chart here again, possibly the most restrictive version of this spell.
At least you don't need concentration, so at least your wizard can go do something else for those 10 rounds.
Yep, but that's pretty short. 10 rounds is pretty different from the utility of turning something invisible potentially permanently, right? And I've seen this in countless old school games where players say, like, oh, well, we're just going to cast invisibility on each other, you know, for a couple of days before it's time to go out, and now we're all invisible.
Right. And players that get started with 5th edition, right, if they enter one of my old school games, among other spells, right, there's usually a moment where they realize how completely unleashed in power the early spells are, and there's usually someone that gasps, goes, oh my god, invisibility just lasts for potentially forever, or the charm monster spell lasts for a year, and there's usually a lot of gasps at how completely unhinged the original spells were.
Which
I don't hate.
Yeah, and it makes you wonder about the world building. Like, if its visibility is permanent and you can cast it on objects, there should be invisible objects everywhere. There should be all kinds of invisible objects. They should be super commonplace.
So this is in my OED house rules, right? This is an issue for all kinds of spells, for darkness and continual light and charm person and invisibility. And so I do have a doctrine with OED that no lower level spell can be permanent for exactly this kind of ridiculous issue. So for me, I have a standard process, like no second level spell can last more than 1 week. So if you play with me, the invisibility spell lasts up to a week, as you saw in the Sajkanth game.
Yeah, but you could still then potentially have that case where the players spend 5 days prior to going down into the dungeon, all casting invisibility on each other. So by the time they're ready, time to get invisible, right? Like, just
correct.
Everybody going invisible.
Yeah. Up until they make their first attack.
Yeah. True. I wanted to comment on the you said you've never seen a player cast it on an object.
I haven't.
Really? You've never? That's funny. Viewers of 10 Dead Rats will remember the ridiculous situation we had in game where my players were trying to smuggle a very large box of drugs into a city. It was like a, you know, like a 4 foot by 3 foot by 3 foot rectangular box that they were trying to smuggle in. And so they had this clever idea to cast invisibility on it. Now it's invisible. Then they realized, but it's going to look pretty weird if we're all carrying nothing, holding up this giant box, carrying this into. So they found a slightly larger box to put it in, and they carried in a visible box containing an invisible box, such that in the hopes that if it was searched, they would be like, it was an empty box. Just an empty box. Which is a very odd usage. There you go.
That's great. So what would be your preference? Like, if we were just starting from scratch and just talking about the second level invisibility spell, how long do you think it should last? Is a week, is multiple days too much? Or?
I prefer it to be longer. I might, if I was going to be as conservative as possible, I would say maybe a day.
I agree.
I could go all the way down to 1 day.
Same for me. If I sat at a game table and invisibility lasted for a day, I wouldn't hate it. That's actually a reasonable place to set it. I set it at 1 week, but I wouldn't hate a day. Less than that, I'm like, you're kind of boring me now.
I think a week is okay. You know, I'm generally, what I'm looking for is I want to make sure. What bothers me is when a lot of spells in third and especially 3.5 and later got boiled down to like just a couple rounds. So now that it really is just about a combat scenario, and I want especially divination spells, and I want utility spells like invisibility that can be used for stealth and sneaking and whatnot to last much longer. I want to see invisible scouts. I want.
Yes.
This is if you remember from Sajkanth also, you may remember that I was very upset at the what I saw as kind of the uselessness of find or locate object because it was so limited in range and duration. Again, that's for the storytelling sake of a game, I like it when those things have infinite range or last at least for concentration, so that we can have these story based things of, you know, I'm searching out or I'm spying on someone across the land or that kind of stuff. I hate it when they're just boiled down to just purely a tactics thing. Because that when 3.5 came out, I often went on record of saying, like, this is the board gamification of D&D. I don't want it to turn into a purely tactical infiltration game. I want these big story elements, and I want spells that serve that.
Likewise, the fact that half of all the spells in 5th edition will have concentration requirement really, it surprises me every single time and bothers me in the same thing. I will just briefly, you know, locate object has always had a pretty limited duration. So in, you know, original D&D, locate object has a maybe 16-inch range, depending on level. I'm just going to grab my BX rules here. Sorry, everybody. So that's...
We don't have to get into arguing over locate objects. Suffice it to say that I don't like that, and I definitely, it's one of the things where I will house rule that, make it much, much larger. Especially when it's not, like, I always rule it as it's just a compass direction. It's not giving you distance, it's not giving you precise location of thing, it's just saying it's that way.
And I think that's really interesting.
I think that's super fun, and that's generally always been fun in my games, that it's this direction. Especially, you know, if you're in a big dungeon and I go, great, your compass points straight down. You go, okay, that's weird. What do we do about that?
It's an interesting house rule. BX, by the way, 60 feet. 60 feet plus 10 feet per level.
Plus 10 feet per level. So a high level wizard is going to get a bigger range. But nevertheless, I don't feel constrained by the origins of the rules. I think that it is a more fun spell. And I would say the same thing for things like clairvoyance. I want those to have. I want clairvoyance's range to be miles, at least, if not infinite.
And in the early editions, they're maybe just the other side of a door, perhaps.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Let me see. Okay, so we talked about duration. Back to invisibility. We talked about the duration that gets dialed down, and we could go down to maybe one day, which is where they had it in second edition. Other ways that folks try to restrict it is, I do feel, looking at the first edition stuff that was written by Gary Gygax himself, I think that he regretted the very high power of invisibility, because he had a whole almost page long section in his DM's guide with a whole bunch of reasons why invisibility is weaker than it initially was. And it's one of these things whereby, and I don't think this was a great design choice, is the tradition was, well, there was no limit in chainmail, and we maintain all, anything that happened in the past, we maintain the same rule. So there's no limit in original D&D, and there's no limit in first edition, but maybe there's a bunch of corner stuff that you hadn't considered that we didn't mention that obviously would be the case. And so, Paul, if you pull up the image with the red dot, this is the kind of errata type stuff that you get in the first edition DM's guide, which was the last book published after a couple of years. And so he has this whole section here, and I snipped out the majority of it, but the thrust of it is invisibility is not what most players desire it to be. And then here's a whole lot of ways where the DM can rule that it's not going to work for you. It's not soundproofing. It's not an odor preventative. Normal sound issues from the invisible creature, just as normal odors do. Monsters might be able to hear them or smell them. Furthermore, the associates of the Invisible Party are not able to see him or her any better than the foes are, so this can cause problems. Now, consider if you have a silent spell and a large area invisibility, which again could be invisibility 10-foot radius or mass invisibility or whatever, cast upon a party. Imagine the chaos within the area as characters stub their toes on the heels of the person before them with the inability to hear anything, so that false suggestions or orders can't be heard, and the dust on the floor will betray most invisibility, as will dust or powder in the air. Think of door openings. This will cause suspicion in the mind of the viewer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that a lot of, you know, maybe when we were teenagers, early old school DMs would read this and go, oh yes, I'm going to screw with the players, and they're going to be stumbling over each other's toes when they use invisibility 10-foot radius. Oh, it'll be a huge gag. And I don't like it. I really strongly dislike that a lot. Interestingly, I just recently learned that 3.0 was the first edition to say that with the invisibility sphere, you can see yourself at least. And then 3.5 was the first to say you can see everybody else in the sphere. That's actually something that I thought I invented until I just learned that in the last month that does actually show up in 3.5. I feel that that's a sensible thing to do. I don't like the Keystone Cops gag. If you go back to Homer, Athena casts invisibility on me. I can see me. I can see her. We can have a conversation. No problem. That's a lot more mythic, a lot more useful, and really I would prefer to run it that way. So I don't like this kind of gag about stumbling over yourself and you can't see your own stuff and all that stuff.
I totally agree with this, Dan. This is exactly the kind of play that I think I described in when we were reviewing Sajkant that Rachel described as actually style of play. Right. Yeah. It's that. Well, let me be very clever and technical and find the corner case that undoes the thing or ruins or changes the situation. I've heard this go as far as arguments like, if you're invisible, then your eyes are invisible and therefore the light passes through your eyes and therefore you're blind because your eyes can no longer receive light.
God, please save me.
Personally, I even kind of don't like that thieves have separate move silently and hide in shadows abilities. Why do I need two dice rolls to be stealthy? Can I just have one die roll to be sneaky? Why do I need to cover every single edge case? I'd also argue this is where you start to get things like monsters who have different senses. Okay, I've got my elven cloak and boots. I'm invisible. I'm silent. Definitely nothing's going to attack me. Oh, unless it has echolocation or tremor sense or heightened sense of smell or any of the other things we want to give our monsters to say, ha ha, gotcha.
I'm a little bit softer on that latter thing, but the first thing of you the first thing of just screwing with invisibility on its own by its own nature, it just doesn't make any sense, because if you couldn't see, you wouldn't use such a thing. It doesn't match any pulp story, doesn't match any mythology or anything like that. So that doesn't make any sense. Now, and one other thing, right? If you could, the other image that I have there, Paul, with the orange dot. So on the next page in first edition, the other thing. Now remember that some creatures in chainmail could detect invisible, right? Dragons and wraiths, also superheroes, right? High level Conan type warriors. Well, in first edition, there's this automatic detection of invisibility table. So if anyone, monster or character, gets 7th level or higher, right, and superheroes are 8th level, you have to consult this table, know what their intelligence is, cross-reference the level and the intelligence, and just any kind of higher level creature has this percentage chance to detect perturbations in the air and thereby foil invisibility. And you do have to roll every single round in an engagement like this. So that's sort of an expansion of what they've got in chainmail, sort of. But I don't know anybody that actually remembered to find this page when it came up and use it. It's a design choice, because the easier design choice would be to say, hey, I got the duration wrong. The duration is now shorter. Done. Or something like that, right? But by committing himself to, we never, ever change anything that there was a prior protocol for, but we are going to add rules that we obviously feel we should have known about in a complicated fashion was a slightly bungled design sensibility.
I assume, again, this is just more attempting to explain the game mechanics with real world physics in ways that it just doesn't make sense, or that this like backwards. Well, okay, so Conan could detect magically invisible creatures because he had really good hearing, or he just had really good kind of danger sense and could detect shifts in the wind or whatnot, and therefore all high-level fighters should have that. I feel like that's... It gets into that fiddly range where I understand wanting the game world to reflect the physical world and physics to be, you know, I don't want to just toss physics out the window. I just also don't want to go down this long line of the let me get out this esoteric science to explain away your magic ability.
It's interesting. That's not exactly the take that I would have, but certainly the rule is too complicated for me. If I need to remember every time invisibility comes up to get that particular page in the DM's guide, cross-reference this particular table, it's just too complex for this thing. Invisibility is going to come up. I don't want to stop the game to find it. For me, that's not a good rule. Just say dragons can detect invisible. Done.
Sure. Sure. Or, I mean, if you really want to say, like, yes, there's, if you want to allow for, you might leave footprints in the dust, or somebody might hear you, or you might, like, all this stuff, just boil it down. Just say, okay, opponents can make a saving throw or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe
agreed.
Detect. Why not?
Agreed.
And it's just simplify. This is the extra explaining away is just too much for me.
Interesting. That's not I will admit that's not the top thing that bothers me about that rule. So we would both expunge that rule for possibly two different priorities.
Well, and I just don't want to get into those arguments at the table. It's the same reason, Dan, I don't like infravision, and I would prefer it's just dark vision. You can see in the dark. Let's not argue about how the light spectrum works. I don't want to have those conversations at the table. I don't want to waste game time arguing about infrared.
If I ever had one of those conversations, I might start coming around to your perspective.
I don't know.
That has right, yet let's, to happen let's... for me.
Well, you're very lucky. I mean, I certainly had a player. I remember I had a player who consistently would always carry around a one pound bag of flour. And that was his detect invisibility. I'm ever worried about there being an invisible creature. I toss the bag into the air and let the flower settle so I can see the invisible creature.
I don't hate it. I actually don't hate it. If I'm accounting for encumbrance, if I'm making them pay encumbrance and it's a one use thing, I don't loathe it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not the best, I think.
I might have had giants do that to you when you were going through the Hall of Fire Giant King, actually. I think I might have done that to you by the monsters.
Okay. Let's talk about objects. Let's talk about objects and items and gear specifically.
Yes.
I cast invisibility on myself, does all my gear go invisible, or is it just my body and I have to get naked to be invisible?
Okay, well, I mean, don't do that. I mean, Odysseus didn't have to didn't show up with the queen butt naked, right? He's got all of his
stuff.
But
that is a common gag we see in invisibility, right? You look at the Invisible Man or a lot of like 80s era things that played with invisibility. It's super funny if, turns out they're you know, they turn invisible and they're naked.
It's stupid.
But it also... I agree it's stupid, but let me ask you this. I cast invisibility on myself, and then I put on a hat. Is the hat invisible? Does the hat become invisible after the fact?
I feel like different DMs are going to have to make different choices. We're not... And that's the problem with invisibility, is that clearly it's not a real-world thing. There's some amount of reasoning where our reasoning just stops. So frankly, I could imagine DMs going either way with that. I could imagine pulling it into my misty personal space and the hat becomes invisible. I could also imagine saying that it wasn't part of the original spell and it's not invisible. I actually could accept DMs going either way with that.
I think it gets very fiddly, and then you end up in these weird corner cases where you're going to have stupid arguments at the table. Ah, but when I picked up the hat and put it on my head, it became invisible. Therefore, when I'm coated in flour, the flour should become invisible, Dan.
Got it. I will admit, I didn't initially think of it actually covering the person. I thought of like leaving a gap that you could see in the air or the footsteps or something like that was my initial take on that. I didn't think of actually being coated with a visible flower. Maybe I'm wrong about that. And then my next thing would be like, is there any case in Lord of the Rings where one of the guys using the One Ring pilfers something and hides it in their cloak or something like that? And I would go looking for some kind of literary precedent and try to follow that, frankly.
I bet you would struggle to find that.
I wouldn't be surprised. You know, here's an example that I just did of that recently. So there's the next level up from the invisibility spell, and it has been there. It was there since original D&D. Is there's a third level spell that was originally called invisibility 10-foot radius, like a couple different spells. Third edition renamed that to the invisibility sphere. Nowadays, it doesn't exist in fifth edition for what it's worth. They just have the lower level spell you can upcast to more people. So they don't have it in fifth edition anymore. But in original D&D, let me just pull it up. As usual, very kind of sketchy, invisibility 10-foot radius. The original one said, I'm going to read the entirety of the description. An invisibility spell with an extended projection, but otherwise no different from the former spell. That's the whole thing. What does that mean? And most of the early editions, first, second, third, what they meant, but what they interpreted as projection is you have to cast it on one focal person, and then everybody else has to stay close to that one person. And if that original person attacks, then it's gone for everybody, but it works differently for the others. And I never liked that asymmetry. That felt incredibly awkward to me. We were dealing with that in the Sajkanth game, and right afterwards, like, yeah, I freaking hate that. So after some discussion on a Discord server, I think most everybody agreed it would be acceptable to say there's no focal creature, but the whole group has to stick within a close radius. And if anybody breaks it, then it's broken for everybody. So I think that's how I'm going to play it going forward. But here's what I did, Paul. The question of can I find an example is, could I find an example in the Iliad, in Homer, of invisibility being cast on a larger group, on more than just one person? And there's a fairly small number of examples. And in each case, it's cast on exactly two people. It's cast on two brothers, two fighter brothers. It's cast on two horses. When someone brings their horses and they don't want the horses at risk, they cast invisibility on the two horses and then leave them behind knowing that they're safe. So my question is, what happens if the two brothers have an argument and walk off, right? You'd have to, by D&D rules, you'd have to pick one focal creature who has priority and keeps the invisibility. That doesn't seem fair at all. But there's no example of two people leaving. So there's actually no example in the Iliad of breaking the spell when you've cast it on two people. And I went hunting for that and couldn't find it. So making the best judgment I can is it doesn't feel like that should be asymmetric. I tried.
This stuff breaks for me, honestly, when it comes down into... It's sort of the old golden rule stuff we talked about, right? That you want to do your best to reflect reality, except where it impedes gameplay. And this is where I start to go, well, it's impeding gameplay, man. Come on. I don't want to waste hours of table time arguing this minutia. Invisible's invisible. Like, it's... I like the idea of, you cast it on a group, we're all invisible, and it's just like I had multiple invisibility spells and I cast it on each individual. That is possibly the easiest way to rule it. Why not?
Interesting. I mean, arguably it's too powerful, right? You already have a problem where invisibility, but, and again, in these rules, it's permanent and originally. So arguably it's too powerful. I don't mind. I myself don't mind being able to cast on your party and they have to stick together as a group. I don't hate that. And again, you know, Odysseus has to stick close to Athena for a while. I don't mind this. Having a group invisibility isn't the worst thing. Now, what you just described is how it works in fifth edition if you upcast it. But I don't hate keeping our group together.
I must have misunderstood what you were arguing for. Then. Are you just arguing for that you don't want one person to cancel it for everybody?
Correct.
That it, yeah, yeah.
Like, I don't want one special person that it works differently on.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
I mean, you can make the argument of, okay, what if I cast it on four people and two go east and two go west? Is it over for everyone? Do two of them get to be main invisible and two of them are not? What happened?
For me, as of July 15th, it's broken for everybody. By the letter of the law in like first edition, it would actually be on for two people and off for the other two people, which I don't like. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Granted that there's a group spell. Do you prefer it that way, Paul? Do you prefer it breaking for everybody simultaneously, or do you prefer it to be on for half of the group?
I definitely don't want to deal with it being on for half of the people. That's just a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
Either it's off for everyone or it's on for everyone.
That's how we're gonna play it going forward. Yep.
You and I might disagree about the on or off part of that.
I see where you're going with that.
Because that's, you know, again, I feel a lot of times I feel like these arguments are putting on these extra limitations, and especially when the player who's playing the magic user, they have a resource, which is spell slots, and they're spending this resource on some in-game helpful effect. And so to put on all these little if you don't do it just right, it goes away. I always feel like it's just mean-spirited. Give them their ability. Let them be cool, man. Let them be cool. They spent the points on it. Just let them be cool.
It seems pretty cool to make your whole party invisible for a week.
I agree.
Seems pretty cool. Okay.
But you got to stay within reach, or it's over. Okay.
Well, that's not some errata. That has been the core rule in first, second, third edition. Ever since that spell existed, that was the point of the spell. So that's not going to come up by surprise and surprise the players. Oh, I didn't know this. That was the core text all along.
Yeah. Again, maybe I'm a little more willing, Dan, to stretch away from the core text, like with locate object.
How dare you?
I don't like what was put here. You know, I don't know. Maybe I'm going to go crazy and eliminate an entire core class from the game. Who knows?
I see what you did there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, a bit, but I wrestle with it. So as folks know, like I try, like if I do too much, I do want people to recognize what I'm doing as D&D. And I do, when I do make these adjustments, I do try to make the smallest adjustment that I possibly can and get away with it. So, I don't want people to have to, like, the problem with 3.5 edition is they made a whole bunch of fiddly changes to all the spells, and we were continually tripping over our, you know, acquired knowledge and our acquired expectations. And I really don't want that to happen to people when they sit at my table. So I do want to keep things, recognizable as much as possible and not change. I certainly don't want to change stuff on the fly. These are the kinds of conversations, decisions that I want to make with you, Paul, offline.
Yeah.
And yeah, not yeah. to be surprising people on the fly because I'm taking away. I don't want to take away powers at the table for the purpose of some plot that I had in mind. Want to make these decisions. You know, the conversations we have is not the same way that I play, I don't think.
Yeah. Yeah. Let me ask you. Let me pick on another particular one that's actually always bothered me, and I don't have a good answer for. Let's say you didn't get rid of clerics and you still have the silence 15-foot radius. And let's say you cast silence and invisibility on yourself so that you can be super sneaky. You're magically sneaky. No one can see you. No one can hear you. You know, you take a shower to try and eliminate your odor as much as possible. You cast a fly spell so that you can fly just a couple inches off the ground so that you're not making any vibrations. Okay. Everything you can to be as super sneaky as possible. Versus, say, magic items that introduce this. We have our elven cloak and boots. And traditionally, the language around elven cloak and boots have always said things like near invisible, near silent, not 100% close to, and often with language that is not particularly clear about what the hell that means.
The important point.
Do you rule that elven cloak and boots is as good as invisibility and silence 15-foot radius? Is it slightly worse? Or do you say, well, technically, also silence and invisibility are imperfect, and there's some tiny chance that you're going to get detected?
It's, you know, it sometimes it's troubling, and I will say that when you were, we don't have the silence spell available, when your character, you know, kind of high level, right, name level, was invisible and flying, and to my mind, flying is going to be pretty darn quiet. I couldn't see any way that there was going to be any obvious, you know, loud sounds. It started to become like, boy, that's some really good, hard to detect scouting, frankly. I do honor the texts that say that the elven cloak and boots is less potent than that. I think, like, you know, in my head, first edition has a specific table that gives it like about 90% or something like that. So I try to remind, to my mind, the elven cloak is more like a chameleon cloak, frankly. So I do try to inform people about that. If you have, you know, by the text, an actual invisibility spell, you're just unseen. And the only way that I can see to get around that would be to have a monster that's specifically mentioned as having a good sense of smell or echolocation or maybe anti-magic. I might actually say that something that, like a golem who is immune to magic, I might possibly say sees through invisibility. But as a general rule, you would just be undetectable, I think.
Hmm. Yeah. I always found if I really wanted to get into that of, okay, the ground is dusty, you might leave footprints. There's like,
yeah,
if the situation warrants it and we go, okay, there's a chance you might accidentally give yourself away through touching things. It's dark, you can't see. Maybe you're going to bump your head or any other little situation. But generally, I agree with you, like invisibility, silent, moving, flying, whatever, it just works unless there's some obvious situation. But I still might want to put a roll on it. And that's what I do for elven cloak and boots is I've always said, well, it's, and this is me being rather generous, I think, compared to some of the other text, is I give it a 5% chance of failure, which I just say, roll a d20 whenever it matters. You might accidentally get detected. If it comes up a natural one, it fails. And that feels good, I think, because, again, because of that emotional connection we have to the d20 and the natural one. We go, of course, critical failure, that's going to happen. And so occasionally I might rule the same for invisibility and silence if, again, situationally we decide, oh yeah, it's a dusty hallway, you might accidentally leave footprints or something like that.
I'm just looking, I don't hate any of this. This all seems pretty reasonable to me. I'm just looking up BX Paul, Elven Cloak and Boots. It says a character wearing an elven cloak will only be seen on a roll of one on D6.
Which is a big, that's like a good 15-16%, right? That's a chunky, it's a much, much higher chance of failure there.
So that is kind of my sensibility for the Cloak of Elvenkind, frankly. I might not remember exactly that rule, but I do remember, you know, pretty chunky, all things considered, as compared to invisibility. So I don't care. I don't mind any of your rulings, Paul. That all seems pretty, it's not exactly how I would do it, but that seems like all pretty reasonable to me, frankly.
It's interesting that you pulled up BX, and I don't remember reading that, but I do remember reading, maybe it's either first edition or original edition, where it's just vague. It just says near invisible, as good as, but not quite.
Agreed.
And you're left to go, what does that mean? I don't know.
In first edition, I think there's like a 12-line table of different like conditions or lighting, light versus indoors versus outdoors that gives you a percentage chance. And again, here's Moldvay saying it's 1 in 6. You know, it's all you need. That's good. It's close enough. And I agree with Tom Moldvay on that.
What else do you have to say about invisibility, Dan?
I'm constantly surprised. I mean, I'm surprised that they made it so short. I mean, we mentioned in 3.5, they started to make some stuff like basically only useful in one encounter. That always surprises me. I was surprised that 5th edition reduced it all the way down to concentration. So it's this really funny... Well, I mean, the other thing that was being discussed in our Discord was... And again, a thing that I'd never thought about is the whole ruling of it breaks when you attack. And, you know, again, maybe the thinking in chainmail was that they're hiding in the underbrush and they pop out and ambush you and now you can track where they are. It's kind of unclear. I can't think of any pulp fiction or myth where people are invisible and then ambush somebody and then they're visible. So it's a little unclear where this came from, but this has been maintained all the way from before D&D all the way into 5th edition. They still have that basic rule of you appear when you attack, and then you have to have a debate about what counts as an attack. So, you know, obviously if you shank someone with a dagger, that counts. And then you have a whole bunch of different nuance rulings in different editions. I think like 2nd edition says, well, you can invisibly cut a rope and drop a trap on somebody, and that doesn't count as an attack, and you're still invisible. You know, I probably, if you cast a fireball, you show up, but can you conjure an elemental and have that attack the opponent? I think there's some edition that says that's legitimate. You stay invisible for that. And that all becomes pretty complicated.
There's so many interesting gray areas, and I'm not kidding about the Odysseus example of, oh, he grabbed her legs.
Yeah.
Right? That's a grapple roll, right? Yeah. That's an attack.
Maybe. Honestly, didn't think about that. I was kind of joking. I didn't think about that, but that's maybe that does actually make sense about that. Possibly.
Really.
And I think it might have been Gamadan. Yeah. I never thought about this, but I think it might have been Gamadan on our Discord that was saying, well, what if you're just like on your own, you don't have anyone around you, and you want to let go of the invisibility spell? Are you out of luck if there's no one to attack? I think someone said their games has a lot of people going around slapping their horses to get rid of the invisibility spell, which I don't like, by the way. I don't like if there's something incentivizing people abusing horses in your campaign, that you need to fix that rule, by the way. Slap yourself would be a better option.
I think it was called out that in 10 Dead Rats there was a case of slapping each other. Just God. slap me, get this invisibility off.
I can't say that's ever been an issue for me, but that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. I'm gonna say that slapping yourself, you should be able to do that.
I would say more commonly I see people trying to use it in terms of like, how do I ride the line of not turn myself invisible but do something that's almost an attack but not quite? Can I, as an invisible person, interpose myself between two combatants and just be, I'm just here, I'm just in the way, making it harder for them to fight, but I'm not attacking anyone.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Right. Or like you said, the cut the rope, or, you know, if I cast pyrotechnics, is that an attack? You know, if it's an area of effect and it doesn't even really hurt anyone, can I cast buffs on myself? Can I,
It's interesting, you know, 5th edition now cancels invisibility with just any spell whatsoever, which I think is the first edition to do that. And I can see the elegance of just wiping out all these arguments. Isn't an insane ruling to make, frankly. But I'm not used to doing it, admittedly.
Yeah. And unfortunately, it has come down to a thing that I just have to be clear with people and adjudicate on the fly at the table. Well, they'll say, I'm going to do X, and I will say, that will cancel your invisibility. Does this count as an attack? And it's a pain. I hate having to do those rulings, but you must. I can't, I don't see any other way around it, especially when players are gonna try and game it. How can I?
I agree.
Or just let them attack while invisible. Now I'm sure there's spells in fifth edition that are like advanced, fancy, invisible, and you still get to attack, and it stays on, right?
That's existed since first edition, right? In first edition, that spell is called Improved Invisibility.
Yep.
Fifth edition, now it's referred to as Greater Invisibility. So that's always been in the rules, and that seems very, very powerful. I can't remember what level it was in first edition. It's probably like around fifth level or something like that. So that every edition since zero has had that capacity, and a bunch of monsters can do that, right? Pixies can do that. They can be invisible. Mm-hmm. And still attack while unseen. So that power has always been in the game.
Yeah. And then you get into, and unfortunately, Dan, we're out of time. I really got to wrap us up.
Oh, my.
The thing that we didn't get to is the whole, how do you track where the invisible creature is? Especially if you're, say, using a battle mat, and you have maybe opposing forces who don't want to know where each other are, but you maybe have players who are saying, well, I'm a fighter, and I know there's an invisible something around here somewhere, so I just start swinging wild. What are the chances that I hit?
I will say briefly, so I was trying to use a hidden movement system in my Wizards Warzone game for a couple of years, and I was trying my darndest. I could just barely make it work, but it was taxing. And so I ultimately, for that particular competitive battle map situation, I did abort that, and nowadays I leave the miniature on the table, and I just tell everybody, this character is invisible. You cannot target them with targeted spells. They have save bonuses. They have armor class bonuses. And you're just going to have to deal with that, because tracking offline where they are is just too complicated for everybody. You're just going to have to accept this gaming idiom here. So I have gotten to the point where if you're using a battle map in miniatures, it's too hard to do anything else. So
it gets sticky, though. Again, if you start to allow things like, well, I can see the miniatures are right next to each other on the board, so I should be able to just swing wildly around, and I'll take the minuses, but I should be able to try to attack, versus, no, I legitimately don't know where they are. They might be 10 feet or 20 feet away, in which case I shouldn't be able to swing wildly. Mm-hmm. And if the miniatures are on the board and I can see that they're 15 feet from me, I'll just move my miniature over here next to them, and then I'm going to swing wild. Yeah. Doesn't that seem
a
little...
In my Wizards Warzone.
Yeah.
It's that's just the game, right? Anything else is too complicated. You are going to have to accept this slight bit of gamism that, they can kind of find where you are. And the game runs better. The game runs a bit better, that particular type of scenario. So that is what I'm doing, and that is what I might possibly suggest. Because you're gonna be unhappy with anything else.
Yep. And again, I think this is similar to what I was saying before. You're getting into that realm of the golden rule of, as real as you can get it until it starts to impact gameplay. And then, gameplay.
I think third edition had an additional, on top of that, additional, like just 50% chance that anything you did would fail against an invisible opponent. And
interesting. Interesting.
You can engage with something like that. That's not insane either.
All right, we are definitely out of time, Dan. Any final thoughts on invisibility?
So I like, I don't hate downgrading the duration a bit. And I think Paul and I both agree you could go all the way down to one day and we would still be willing to play with our kind of old school sensibilities. So maybe not totally permanent. If you tell me that your invisibility can't be cast on an object, Paul, I could accept that. I allow it on objects, but if you don't want to do that, that's okay. I do think that because you're going to have to make these rulings, and you're going to have a whole bunch of, players pushing the boundaries of what you can do. So for me, it really helps to pick some kind of mythological precedent, some kind of model for what you're talking about. And if you're talking about a transparent person, like in The Invisible Man in the 20th century, and you have to get naked, so be it. And if you're thinking about something in Homer of a magical mist surrounding the person that no one can see into, use that. And that will at least help you make some of these decisions on the fly and keep them kind of in the theme. I don't like a bunch of gags of, you trip over yourself, you can't find stuff in your backpack, your eyeballs are invisible and you can't see anything. That is not going to be good long-term for your game. So pick something that someone did think about in literature, use that as a model. I think that's going to help guide your decision-making process when you do have to deal with those adjudications.
Yeah, I think my major takeaway here is that what I'm noticing, Dan, is that we didn't come up with any like real good hardline rules here. And I just don't think it's possible. It is such a fiddly spell. You're always going to find yourself in the edge cases and the corner cases, and you're just going to have to deal with it and run with it and make calls on the fly.
I think we did come up with some stuff not to do. Don't use the first edition trip over your own feet thing. Don't use the percentage chance to detect stuff. Come up with something simpler than that. Don't reduce it all the way down to concentration. So I think there's a lot of bad options that we did, agree that we should not do. And then granted, you're still going to have some corner cases. Like I think a good model in advance will help guide you.
Yeah, I agree. Viewers, if you have thoughts on how to adjudicate invisibility, other edge cases we didn't think of that you want to bring up, or other mythical or literary sources that you could use as inspiration, please leave a comment here in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe that'll help push the conversation along. Or better yet, join the Patreon. Come join us in Discord and bring up your topics, and we'll discuss it in more detail there.
I'm looking forward to that. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We are on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle WandrianDems on all those sites. So please look for us there and just totally dematerialize that like button.
If you prefer to listen to the show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com. Also available through various podcast carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on a third-party website and it gives the ability to do so, please consider giving us a 5-star review. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, and we would love you if you did that, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And like Paul said, every tier gets you access to a private Discord server where the conversation is continuing 24/7 with the most intelligent, wise, charismatic patrons in all the land. And it's just great ideas that spawn into shows for us, or answer questions for me, or solutions that I hadn't thought of myself. And just so much great stuff there. We would love for you to join us there. Paul, I'm actually wandering myself the next couple weeks. So I may possibly generate some footage of interesting places that I haven't been to myself. But I actually will not be available the next two Sundays. But I think you have some stuff planned where you're going to have conversations or games or possibly novel guests. So you'll be holding down the fort the next two Sundays, I think?
Yeah. I'm looking for something. I haven't quite figured it out yet. So if you have suggestions, come join us on the Discord. Give them to me. Stuff you'd like to see. I'm not going to get on here for an hour and just lecture. That's not my style.
What?
But if I
would do
find...
that.
Yeah, I know you would. But... if I can find a guest to join me, I will, or maybe I'll just do some live streaming of myself playing some game or something. We'll figure it out. There will be some content on the channel for you all, in the coming weeks, still undetermined what it's going to be. So keep your eyes peeled on our socials, come join us on our Discord, and be part of the conversation, help us figure out what to do while Dan is away.
Huge thanks to Paul. Thank you so much for holding down the fort for the 2 weeks that I'll be away there. Really appreciate it. So I will be back in 3 Sundays from now. And don't forget, everybody, we are live one form or the other every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.